Hi everybody, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to CKUT. This is It Could All Be So Simple. I'm your host, Tara. I use they, them pronouns, and I am a non-binary, queer, Punjabi person living here in Jojage, colonially known as Montreal. I am taking over this show, or part of the revamp of it. I'm here with Jack. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Great, thank you. My name is Jack. I am the spoken word coordinator here at CKUT. So basically, my department is everything on the air that isn't music. I am non-binary and I'm queer. I am a white settler living here in Jojage, or as you said, colonially known as Montreal. Yeah, that's me.
Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And thank you so much for helping with all your support. I'm really excited for the conversations that are going to happen throughout the show and today and the things that we're going to talk about. Yeah, I'm just excited to get to know you more as well.
Very cool. Yeah, I'm super excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. I was wondering a bit more about what queerness means to you. it's a big question.
Yeah.
It's a very big question. And just, yeah, your journey or anything you want to share.
Cool. I love opening with like a hard hitter. Yeah. So what queerness means to me? I mean, queerness is an expression of identity, of attraction. So I identify as queer because it covers the fact that I'm not heterosexual. I'm interested in people of all sorts of, you know, genders. And I think something that's really important to me about the term specifically queer, as opposed to, you know, any of the other terms that fall under or like that go along with that, is that to me, queerness is a rejection of normalcy. And it's a rejection of tradition and expectation. So you always, like, I always see that quote that's like, you know, not gay as in happy, but queer as in fuck you. And like, it's a little bit, it's a little trite because it's out there like on t-shirts or whatever, but that element of queerness, that it's like in some ways a rejection of things, and in other ways it's a celebration of difference. It's a celebration of things that are messy, that don't fit into a particular label, that are transitional and transcendental and fluid and unquantifiable and unqualifiable, and just, you know, things that are ever changing and cannot be contained or controlled. That's why I identify as queer. And I think coming into that identity is something that I did pretty early in life, because I was always like a pretty precocious kid, which, like, I guess you could also say pretentious. I've always been really like interested in sort of iconoclasm, and like as a small child, I was like kind of into anything that pissed adults off. So, like, I knew pretty early on that I was weird, because my family situation was weird. I grew up with well, a mom and no dad. I found out that I was a test tube baby when I was like pretty young. And just growing up with no dad, I would always tell other kids and sometimes adults that my father was the devil or that I was an alien from outer space or, you know, just kind of like whatever story would like kind of make people be like, oh. And I mean, there's like a whole other story there in and of itself. But yeah, I think I've always just been really attracted to things that are kind of, you know, a little bit weird or to certain people a little bit off-putting. And I've always, you know, I've always found as like my people, quote unquote, other like freaks and weirdos and people who are maybe like not totally socially acceptable.
Right.
And then that led me to making a lot of like queer and gender non-conforming friends pretty early. In that way, when you're like a kid who gets picked on a lot, those friendships became really important and sort of like sticking together and having community became, you know, everything. And that really solidified for me at like a pretty young age how like important queerness and community are and how those things are like really linked for us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that.
I feel like I rambled a little.
No, it's great. It's great. It's beautiful. It's beautiful to listen to and hear about your journey and your trajectory. And I think it takes a lot of courage, a lot of vulnerability with ourselves to even be able to reach into ourselves and to understand that there's something there that may not be acceptable, but we're willing to sit with it and to see that that is something that is worth understanding and it's worth tending to and it's worth uncovering that authentic parts of ourselves. These are some of the most beautiful parts. Yeah, I'm just very, yeah, I feel very happy that there is so much community in queerness and there's so much community in people who feel like they don't fit in. And just finding that connection is so important, so powerful just to be witnessed, you know? How do you think that finding community, making community, has changed for you over time since you were younger? How has that changed or how has it evolved?
So, you know, when you're young, your friend group tends to like form sometimes naturally out of like your peer group, the people that you go to school with, the people that you, you know, play on the playground with or whatever. And you can build really, really strong bonds with those people that, you know, may last a lifetime. A lot of times they don't. I found as an adult, it can be a little harder to like find community or even to make friends because the idea of like the commons and the social spaces where we are around each other and where we can get to know each other is just so different. We might make friends at work with our coworkers. Mm-hmm. Or we might not, because that might not be a place where it's really like safe to be who we actually are.
Mm-hmm.
We might make friends, you know, at bars when we go to shows for drinks with our friends, if that's a thing that we do. But all of those places, other than work, obviously, all of those places are like places that we choose to be rather than places that we just kind of like naturally are. So it can be a lot harder as an adult to find friends. And like, I'm not from Montreal. I moved here 7 years ago, and it took me ages to feel like I had a community because, well, that's also a long story. There's a lot of stuff wrapped up in that, but you have to make a conscious decision to do more than just make friends, like to do more than go to a show and say hi to people or, you know, hang out with your coworkers after work or whatever. There has to be the conscious choice of like, this person is going to become an acquaintance and then they're going to become a friend. But then community is like a little bit more than that. It's the like, when something happens, who do I show up for? Who's going to show up for me? And yeah, that's something that takes a certain amount of like intention and a certain amount of, you know, I think luck, and it takes some effort. So how it's evolved for me is, you know, I went from having this built-in group of friends just by virtue of like living in the same place for a really long time and knowing people to coming here, not knowing anybody, not really knowing how to meet people. And then just sort of a constant process of like showing up and like intentionally trying to develop a community. And I can say that it's like paid off now, but it was definitely a hard haul.
Mm-hmm. And this is something something that I've heard from other folks I've talked to recently as well, that when I talk to them about community or when I talk to them about building friendships, a common theme is that it takes time, and it takes mm-hmm. time to kind of find your people and find the people that, like, as you said, it's more than, you know, moving from acquaintance to friend. It's also it takes effort, and it takes energy and time mm-hmm. and it takes intentionality. And I think that is something that is not always present for various reasons, and there's a lot of systems that are also very much mm-hmm. making it difficult for this connection to happen or for these communities to form and happen in sustainable ways. Community is like even a resistance in a way. It's resistance to structures that don't want to see us in community and don't want people to have people who do show up for them mm-hmm. and who make them feel as though they're powerful and that they're taken care of and that they're loved, because love is such a powerful thing. How do you relate to love and community?
Well, I love what you just said about there existing forces in the world that, you know, try to stop us from having community, because especially sort of like white, Western, patriarchal, heteropatriarchal society really does disincentivize community or mm-hmm. make community difficult. This whole idea of kind of like the rugged individual, and then even the idea of kind of like the nuclear family, all of these social forces exist to keep people sort of atomized, keep them in small groups that are not like radically connected to each other. And one of the most important things to me about love and community is its like radical potential of like we exist, you know, all of us, and then like each of us to a certain degree and extent in a world that disempowers and disenfranchises us, and in a world that like makes it really difficult to exist. Love and community can, I'm like, I talked myself into a corner. I guess basically what I'm trying to say is that sort of the force to counter all of that, but then also the thing that that entire structure is trying to like make impossible mm-hmm. is love and community. Because mm-hmm. if we genuinely love each other and we genuinely think of ourselves as being in community with each other mm-hmm. and I mean, you know, I am in community with a lot of people. Like I'm in community with my community, but I'm also in community with the people who exist in the world around me, which includes, you know, my coworkers, my neighbors. It includes the homeless folks that live in my neighborhood. And if I can truly like understand myself as being in community with those people, then I have to take on a certain amount of survival and the ability to thrive of every other person with whom we're in contact. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's like the worst possible thing for capitalism. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess, you know, love and community mean a lot of things to me, but probably the most important aspect of that is like the radical potential. Love and community are the things that like have the potential to break down all of these like really harmful structures that exist.
They do. At least for me, when I've been in really loving community or even had the ability, the capacity to recognize that I'm loved, being receptive to love and understanding what love means. In those situations, in those times, I've been really able to feel my most authentic self and feel into my own personal power. I think that collective power is so connected to personal power. Mm-hmm. The more that we feel personally powerful and able to be ourselves in the world and show up as who we are, and also just be held accountable by the people around us, it enables us to do things that maybe we never thought we would be able to do. You know, we need each other. For me, like, it's still very weird when I'm walking down the street and people are not meeting my gaze, or, you know, there's so much coldness. What you're saying about just everybody feeling so disengaged or even ambivalent from one another. And I think that especially here in the city where we're all connected, there's communities that are connected to one another, but it still feels very, very segregated and separate and distanced. And I definitely felt that distance moving here recently and feeling like, you know, I really want to connect with people, but how do I do this? And it can be very challenging to find community, to feel a part of community, to feel like you can trust people, especially since we're taught to not trust one another and to be suspicious, to not be open to these things.
And I mean, so much of us have experienced trauma in so many different ways, and that affects our ability to trust. And I know a thing that I've struggled with a lot is, like, I love to be supportive. I love to, like, put myself out there for other people. But I, like, asking for that kind of support, or, like, being vulnerable enough to be like, oh, I actually need things too, is really, really, really difficult for me. And that's maybe sort of the freshest thing that I've learned about the idea of community is, like, if you are consistently showing up for other people and then fading into the background and sort of invisibilizing yourself and, like, dealing with your struggles yourself, like, that's a way to be.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes it more difficult to sort of, like, form a community, because the reciprocity of acts of care is so important. And so, like, being able to be vulnerable and be like, I also need support, and here are mm-hmm. the things that, like, I need from the people around me, that turns out to be the piece of it that I was missing.
Definitely. It can be so challenging to ask,
mm-hmm.
because I think that a lot of the times, at least for me, being made to feel like a burden, or me being made to feel as though, you know, to minimize our needs, as mm-hmm. though, you know, we have to constantly be giving or constantly be offering ourselves up, but not having that being reciprocated. Yeah, even just the ways that things are structured in society, you know, having to go to work, or, you know, being used, our bodies and energy and time being used in ways that are not fully consensual or just completely non-consensual, I think really contributes to, like, a collective dissociation and people feeling as though maybe they have needs, but they're not even aware of what their needs are because they're just so numb.
That is such a thing. Yeah, I mean, it took me years of therapy to be able to, like, articulate the thing that you just said about, like, you know, sometimes you have needs or desires or boundaries or whatever, and a product of your, you know, your socialization and the experiences that you've had in the world has made it impossible for you to understand those or to, like, perceive them. And, like, learning how to get in touch with what you want and what you need, and then also what your boundaries are, is, like, that's, like, pretty serious work for a lot of people.
And I think that it kind of multiplies depending on your positionality and your marginalization. Growing up as an immigrant and seeing my parents struggle in different ways and how they have had to minimize their needs or pretend that they don't have needs, or not even knowing what their needs are to begin with because their needs were not seen as important. Just internalizing that and being unable to even fully take care of themselves. It's definitely a universal experience, and it's also very nuanced too, mm-hmm. depending on your, like, particular set of experiences and the circumstances you're in. And yeah, just coming back to love and how love in big ways and also tiny ways too, like articulating love, like saying I love you, but love also being something actionable,
mm-hmm.
like bell hooks talks about and writes about, is very interesting.
I mean, shout out to bell hooks. Mm-hmm. If you haven't read bell hooks, writing on love, like, highly, highly, highly recommend that.
Just everything that we're talking about is preceded by history of Black feminist scholars, Indigenous scholars, and, like, BIPOC folks as well. Just, you know, speaking from experience, and there's so much to be said for having community that just witnesses you, just being a witness. I think it's just very powerful. It's a beautiful thing to be held in community, to be held and to be seen.
To be able to witness someone and have them witness you is such a powerful thing. To be held by a community where people love you enough to tell you when you are doing something that's harmful, and then, like, being able to trust in that love enough to take accountability for it. That's transformative. Like, that is sort of the type of justice that we talk about when we talk about transformative justice, where it doesn't necessarily rely on things like ostracization, or obviously, like, the extreme of that, which is incarceration, but where, like, our communities love each other enough to mm-hmm. point out and deal with, like, harmful behavior.
Mm-hmm. how do you think that finding community has shaped your relationship with yourself?
I would say that finding a community of people who are like me in the sense that they are, you know, people who like fall outside of some kind of norm. So people who are like queer, people who are neurotypical, people who are, you know, anarchists, who are weirdos, who are just, you know, who are like me in the sense that they're different. Mm-hmm. I don't have a better way of saying it than that. It allows and empowers me to be fully myself in those ways. In that way where, like, you know, if you go to a dance party and you're the only person on the dance floor, it, like, feels really weird. Mm-hmm. And, like, I find in that kind of situation, like, if I can work up the courage to dance, I feel, like, disjointed and out of touch with my body. And, like, my emotions are really weird because I'm so self-conscious of them. Versus, you know, if you go to a dance party and there's one person dancing awkwardly in the middle of the dance floor, and then you go dance on the other end of the dance floor or next to that person, and all of a sudden it feels like a little more natural and it's like fun. And then other people join in and dance, and then, you know, everybody joins in and dances, or nobody else does, and there's like two or three people in the middle of the dance floor, but you still have a great time. There's just that sort of like tacit permission to be that comes with being around people and being like accepted by or connected to people who, you know, you have some sort of common ground with, mm-hmm. even if it's just that you both happen to be on the same dance floor at the same weird dance party, you know?
Mm-hmm. Permission to be yourself, permission yeah. to express yourself. Having people who are like you is so important in just feeling self-acceptance mm-hmm. and feeling it's okay to be myself, and it's not strange, and it's not something that I need to hide. It's mm-hmm. not something that I need to be ashamed of. I think that shame, that's a whole conversation.
That is a whole conversation.
That is a whole conversation.
I remember back in sort of the Tumblr years, I was like a big Tumblr kid, reading something about shame being kind of like the antithesis to creativity. And kind of like really, really thinking about that idea of like, whether it be, you know, the creativity to like make art, but also just the creativity to like live authentically, because I think that that does require just a certain amount of kind of like an innate creativity, to know or understand or fashion yourself in a way that is different from sort of like a norm. And how shame is this force that tries to make everything the same. Mm-hmm. Because any way in which you are an outlier is something that will be punished by being shamed. And, you know, an obvious antidote to that is just community, because it feels a lot less shameful to be an outlier if, you know, you're around other people that are outliers in mm-hmm. some way.
I feel like it also offers a sense of safety mm-hmm. and comfort, knowing that you are not the only person. Mm-hmm. You're not the only one that is, mm-hmm. and there are others. And it's a very powerful thing, because it means that on some level you have to actually own who you are. You actually have to step into that. Mm-hmm. And that takes a lot. It takes a lot to express those parts of yourselves, especially if it's not widely accepted. But in those spaces, it is seen as something that can be celebrated, and it's something that's beautiful, just because it's who somebody is inherently. I also think it speaks to like our humanness too, and how just by the fact that we're human and we're here, we're deserving of love and acceptance, and we don't have to do anything to deserve it. We don't have to be a certain way. We don't have to conform in certain ways, even though the shame tells us that we have to at times, and it can feel so consuming.
Yeah, I've always really like struggled with the idea of deserving anything, like as in being like, I am a person and therefore I am deserving of love. I wish that I or we or whatever had better ways of phrasing that thought. We are, you know, deserving of love because we exist. And the idea of like deserving seems so transactional in a way, or like, I guess, has been culturally defined as transactional. I did a hard thing today, therefore I deserve a treat, you know? where I think the really important truth of it is just that we deserve goodness and we deserve care and we deserve rest and love just by virtue of being, which again, like is really what you were saying. But I just, that the phrasing of like deserving something, I just wish I had a better way of expressing those thoughts.
Yeah, that is interesting. It's interesting that you bring that up. And I think like the language that we use is important. And I think that for me, when I think of deserving, I think feeling something inside of myself that has always felt undeserving. Mm-hmm. So when I say deserving, I'm resisting that part or those voices that make me feel like I'm an imposter or make me feel like I don't deserve certain things unless I do something, mm-hmm. which is like speaking to the transactional. Part of what you're saying is that, yeah, we don't have to do something to be deserving of something else. It's just that just by the fact that we're here, we're just deserving.
That's the rub. It's like you get to the end of that sentence and you're like, oh, there's no other word to use here. But yeah, that the part of it where it's like you, like most people will have culturally or societally ingrained into them this idea that like you don't deserve good things, you know, you mm-hmm. don't deserve care, you don't deserve to take up space, you don't deserve whatever because you're not good enough. Or you deserve bad things to happen to you because you're bad. And, you know, you can flip the script on that and be like, well, no, I actually do deserve good things because I'm not bad. And that's like a really important realization, or it's like an important narrative to have to counter the like little horrible gremlin voice in the back of your head. And I don't want to like discount that by my own sort of personal taking issue with like the whole concept of deserving things. Because it comes from the same thing for me where I'm just like, to hell with this idea. I'm just so annoyed about it that I want to get rid of that word entirely.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense. And I think that it's also wound up in like binary thinking that mm-hmm. is also imposed on us, conditioned to think in ways that are very binary of certain people being deserving of certain things or certain people being undeserving, or this idea of good and bad is also very carceral. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take into account nuance, and it doesn't take into account the ways in which people can be held accountable to change and the nuances of harm. And yeah, there's a lot of complexity there that gets discounted when certain words are used or certain ways of describing things that are very binary or very black and white. And I think that it also speaks to the limitations of the English language and the limitations of the ways in which we're taught to think.
Yeah, that is such a thing about sort of like the dominant paradigms that we live under, that they love a binary. Probably the way that we see this the most right now is in the binary of gender and in this like surge of transphobia or trans antagonism in the United States and, you know, all over the place, but like it's really coming up in American headlines right now. And this like insistence, almost like rabid insistence, that like there are only two genders. There's male and there's female. Science doesn't back that up. History doesn't back that up. The things that we know to be true about ourselves and like the world that we live in doesn't back that up. But people are so invested in the idea of a binary because it's a way to say like, this thing is this and not that. Like I think at its most like basic level, it's like a way of overcoming like information overload and sort of paring the world down into something that's easy to understand by saying like, this thing is either this or it's not. And then your brain doesn't have to grapple with like the incredible amount of variation and nuance mm-hmm. and all of that stuff. But then also, you know, it's something that power uses to make decisions about like who is worthy of what, who deserves what, who gets things, who doesn't get things. Yeah, seeing people who like really shouldn't have any investment in the idea of a binary make it their hill to die on or their hill to kill on, which is really like the scarier part. It's just so, I mean, it's upsetting, it's confusing. I don't have a nice way to taper that off because it's looming so large right now. But yeah, this idea of binary and this like incredible investment in binary, it's such a big part of everything that's wrong with the world.
And I think it also speaks to the colonizer's subconscious and how the colonizer views the world, and also just white fragility and the fragility of patriarchy, the fragility of all of these dominant systems that require domination, that require certain folks to be repressed in order to enforce their power, to enforce their perspectives, to enforce their way of viewing the world. Because if other people are different, if there's any bit of nuance or complexity, then it has to be destroyed because it challenges their power. It shines a light on the fragility of the systems that we live under, and it's dangerous for them. Everything is so... And it can be, you know, just a bit of poking and poking and they're very angry and they project that anger onto the world.
In order to have power, you need a hierarchy, right? And in order to establish a hierarchy, you have to have like stable, easily defined categories of people that are going to occupy different levels of that hierarchy. And were we to actually, not we, you and I, but like were we broadly... to accept that those kind of like stable categories are an invention of history, and that, you know, things are much more nuanced than that, and things are more complicated than that, and like stable identity categories either don't exist or they don't work the way that we've like been told that they exist, or that we've been told that they do. That would be a threat to the entire like hierarchy of power, which so much of like the world, I guess, has been built on, or sort of like the governing structures of the world mm-hmm. have been built on. So yeah, it's really threatening to have those called into question, to have people point out that like maybe these categories aren't as stable as people insist they are, or for people who have been in sort of the lower parts of that hierarchy to be like, there's actually nothing that justifies this hierarchy. There's nothing that justifies some people being lower than others. That's such a threat.
Because it's not based in reality. A lot of it is just based in delusion. It's based in the fantasy that there are certain people who don't deserve certain things over other people. And it's very transient, and the slow shifting of things. The outrage is evidence of the slow change. Yeah, I've just been observing in younger folks around me, people I've been interacting with, how much more comfortable people are in actually expressing who they are and expressing their views and mm-hmm. being themselves more authentically. It is something to be celebrated.
Absolutely. It's beautiful and it's magical. And it's like, I think about queer elders and I think about like all of the people that we lost to homophobia, whether it be like the AIDS crisis or everything else that stacked against us. And I think about how this is the world that they wanted. It's not yet, but like these small developments, these small ways in which there's more space to be yourself. And, you know, the backlash to that, this like people who are in power and powerful structures like doubling down on all of that is a reaction to, you know, people being less and less invested in those systems of power. And I want that to be really hopeful. You know, it's hard to access that hope.
It is. It can be difficult for sure. Hope is something that has always endured, especially in terrifying times, especially mm-hmm. in times where violence is so explicit, people are so unafraid to express their hatred towards folks who are just trying to live their lives and just trying to survive and just trying to be here. It ties back to, or links back to what we were saying about community and the power of love, and how these things that seem very small and insignificant, like taking care of a friend or reaching out to somebody or even just connecting with neighbors or people around us, it seems small, it seems insignificant, but it's small changes that affect bigger systems and eventually form these changes that we're seeing and that we're talking about.
Yeah, I feel like I don't know if we've like gotten far away from where you wanted to steer this. So if you need to bring it back.
Sure, yeah. Maybe we can talk a bit about love more.
Okay.
I love to talk about love. I love to think about love and what that means and how our understandings of love change over time and how other people impact our understandings of love. Do you want to speak to your experiences as they pertain to queerness and love? And yeah, what does queer love mean to you?
Oh, okay. I guess, like, I'm a hopeless romantic in a lot of ways. Like, I love love. I fall in love really easily. I love to be very expressive about my love. And so I think that it is related to queerness, but it's related in kind of a nebulous way to say that, like, I love people in my life in, like, really intense ways. And it's more to me than romantic love. And there's also sort of a less clear distinction between, you know, romantic love and quote unquote platonic love, wherein, you know, I have a few partners and I love all of those people. And I have friends who I love, like, just as much. And those friends and my partners also, like, these people constitute my chosen family. And I love those people, yeah, really, really intensely. And I like to express my love. And I don't think that I can necessarily define exactly what love is, because it's, you know, a combination of feelings, and it's indefinable in a way, I think. Maybe it's not like that for everybody, but for me, it's, like, not something that I can put, like, a specific language to. But one thing that I have, or that I do genuinely believe, is that, like, queerness allows for a more expansive definition of, like, what love is, because it, I mean, right away, as soon as queerness comes into the picture, then it's like, love is not just between a man and a woman, and then it's also like, love is not just between romantic partners, mm-hmm. and, you know, love can exist in so many different ways. I can be madly in love with somebody I've never met who lives on the other side of the world, who mm-hmm. I may never meet. I can express the words, like, I love you, to, you know, so many different people, and have that be, like, a true, genuine feeling. Yeah.
Thank you. I resonate a lot with that. I think that queerness brings into question what love is in the first place. It's made me understand that I'm not just in loving relationship with someone that I'm romantic with, which could be emotional or physical or however that relationship is defined. I'm in loving relationship with the earth as well. Mm-hmm. I'm in loving relationship with my friends, as you were saying. I'm in loving relationship with my family, and all of these kinds of loves, these different dimensions of love, are expressed differently and they show up differently. You know, thinking about love for an animal that we're taking care of, or thinking about love for teachers that have really shaped who we are. I hold a lot of love for even, you know, authors and scholars and academics, writers, people who have shaped who I am, whose words kind of sit in the fibers of my being. And it's, yeah, I think queerness just opens up so many possibilities of what does it mean to be loved, and how love is something that surrounds us, and it's something that's kind of woven into the fabric of everything that we do. It's kind of woven into everything in the universe and that we experience. And queerness has helped me come to that understanding.
I think, like, the best way that I can articulate love is, like, something of me is invested in every, you know, person. And I mean that in, like, the most expansive sense of the term, because, you know, I do have loving relationships with the environment, with the earth, with, you know, things that are more sort of, like, intangible and spiritual. And I think it's just this recognition of, like, something of me is invested in the thing that I love, and something of the thing that I love is, like, invested in me in a way.
And just even understanding that love is not something that's fixed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just something that is shared between two people and they pour love into each other, but are kind of not really attentive to the other ways in which they engage with the people outside of that mm-hmm. construct. It's almost even imaginative too. I think it opens up something in the imaginary, to think about how can this something that's so powerful be used to incite change in the world and to incite change, yeah, just in communities. Is there anything else that you would like to share, or something that has just come to mind that you'd like to talk about? Or
like, I'm so interested in your answers to these questions, mm-hmm. and in like your perspectives of these things. So, you know, what is love and what does community mean to you?
It's something that I'm still uncovering. It's something that I'm still coming into understanding of. The more that I understand myself and what I value in the world, and also just uncovering the ways in which my perspectives have been shaped by the ways in which I was raised and the values, the cultural values that were instilled in me, and thinking about how really owning who I am and owning the fact that, you know, I don't conform to the gender binary. I don't conform to heterosexuality. I don't conform to these things that seem like the quote unquote right thing to do. I think that has really expanded the ways in which I view myself and the world, and understanding that, you know, just because something seems easy or seems comfortable, it doesn't necessarily mean that it will make me happy. So community and love for me is really feeling into what feels good for me, and what does even feeling good feel like, mm-hmm. you know? how does that feel in my body? How does that land with me? And how can I invite more of that instead of turning away from it, and being open to receiving more of that, and being open and receptive to people loving me and to people expressing their love for me, and how love is also like boundaried, and love can have these firm but flexible ways of being, and also just be very giving, and can hold me in ways that I have never been held before, or never thought were possible. So it's also just about being like, oh wow, this is really nice, and it feels really good. And it just feels nice to be accepted and to be seen for who I am, and to be heard in ways that I never thought that I would be able to be heard. Yeah, which is, I think that having these conversations just about love and community and understanding people's different perspectives, it's so interesting because it's something that we all experience, and it's something that we all experience very differently. Mm-hmm. And it's so complex, and there's just so much to talk about and mm-hmm. to explore. And it's so beautiful. It's beautiful that we're even able to have these conversations, that love is something that we've experienced, that it's something that we've had the privilege and the blessing of having in our lives, because it is something that, you know, can really change things, mm-hmm. and it can really, going back to like imagination, and open up new possibilities that maybe were not there before.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I love that. That's such a good answer. I like especially the way in which that touched on the idea of like pleasure, of like orienting, of finding a space in which, or which allows you to orient yourself toward like receiving things that feel good.
Yeah.
And how that's not something that comes sort of like naturally to everyone. Like a lot of factors that can kind of distance ourselves or distance us from like the concept of pleasure, and how that's related to love, and how feeling safe and being able to be vulnerable opens you up to the ability to receive love, to receive feeling good, mm-hmm. and like receive pleasure. And I have found that, you know, community is one of the things that allows me to sort of orient myself to that, mm-hmm. rather than orienting myself by obligation and being like, well, here are the things that I have to do because, you know, those are the things that make me a good person, and those are the things that make me useful in the world, and you know, those are my debts to pay, versus like I am on the path that I'm on, and I choose to do the things that I do because they bring me joy and they bring me pleasure. And sometimes they're like hard and they require work, but they like increase my capacity for love and the amount of love that I feel, rather than just like you know, checking off the box of like the thing that I think that I'm supposed to be doing. And community is something that kind of like enables and facilitates that to me, because it's like, I find that it's much harder to live in a place of like, you know, negativity and self-loathing when I am held in community and surrounded by love.
For sure. And I think that coming here has been about understanding how can I balance being in community and, you know, socializing and being with people and also being on my own and being in solitude and striking a balance between those two things and understanding how can I show up for myself in ways that are nurturing and nourishing, and I'm taking care of my basic needs and I'm, you know, taking care of my mind and my body in ways that are helpful and conducive and helping me show up for other people as well. Because when I am able to show up for myself in ways that I'm gentle with myself and gentle with, you know, the way that I look at myself in the mirror even, the more gentle I am with myself, the more gentle I am with other people. So I think like that interplay is also really interesting to think about.
Yeah, and I find that in a lot of ways, like, I learn those things from observing people in my community. Like, I can observe someone who is really good at treating themselves well and then be like, oh, like, maybe that's how you do that. Mm-hmm. And then try it out with myself and be like, how does that feel? And then be like, oh, well, that doesn't feel good. But, like, if I adjust it in this slight way, then, oh, wow, that's the thing. That's how I take care of myself. And, you know, we are, like, intensely social beings, and we do learn by, like, I don't know if you can hear that, I keep slapping the microphone, but yeah, we learn by observing the people around us, and so like community does play a big part in like how we learn to love ourselves and other people.
Mm-hmm. Even, you know, nourishing ourselves in community, it feels very good. I always say that food tastes so much better when you're eating it with other people, when you're cooking with people. Mm-hmm. Taking care of oneself, I think, is something, at least for me, I'm learning, it's like a practice. It's something mm-hmm. that takes intentional work again, and it takes intentionally or believing that I am somebody who deserves care and deserves love. And yeah, being around folks who that's kind of more normal for them, it also helps normalize that.
It's so interesting the way that we just came from like macrocosm to microcosm, mm-hmm. where we started by talking about how building community takes work and intention, and we're finishing on like how building a relationship with yourself requires work and intention, but mm-hmm. it's the same work.
Yeah.
Really cool.
It is. It's all connected. It's all very, it may seem like something private, like, oh, how I talk to myself or what my thoughts are like towards myself. It seems very like, oh, nobody's ever going to hear this. Mm-hmm. Nobody's ever going to witness this. Nobody's around, but it all has an effect and an impact.
As above, so below, you know?
Well, thank you so much for talking with me and for being here and for sharing your thoughts and your experiences and your insights. And it was a very beautiful conversation, and I'm really grateful that we got to chat. And thank you to our listeners as well for being here.
Thanks all of you. And this has been genuinely a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And yeah, we hope to see you. Or Let's not see you.
Hear you.
Hear you.
Well, or you'll hear us. Or at least you'll hear them.
Oh, yes.
In a month.
In a month. And yeah, be sure to follow us on social media. We're on all the podcast platforms. Yep. And yeah.
CKUT.ca and CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Thank you.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaweetsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
Our next speaker here is Viola Thomas. She is also a residential school survivor.
Part of our obligation where I work with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada is to inform Canadians on the truth. But I believe that as more Canadian people understand that this was Canadian law and Canadian policy, and that Canadians need to take responsibility for the shared history, I also believe that Canadians have a responsibility to resonate reconciliation with the First Peoples of this country. And what did we learn when we went to the school? We learned how to be bullies, how to be mean to each other, how not to love, how not to feel a great sense of pride of who you are and where you come from. I learned about racism, and I didn't know what that was. I really didn't know what racism was. I learned about sexism, and as a young girl, I didn't know about sexism. There were many forms of abuse, not just the physical, but the intellectual abuse. To always be reminded that you're stupid and that you're nobody. To be told by your teachers and by the folks from the church that you're a savage, you're a squaw. And I just want to close with one of my heroes, a woman by the name of Winona LaDuke. And I offer this to all of our brothers and sisters who were abducted to residential schools. And I offer this with a good heart to non-Indigenous people so that they will pick up the torch. And this is what she says. There is no social change fairy. There is only change made by the hands of individuals.
You have just heard at Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to their shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
MuTech Montreal, the most important festival for digital creativity and electronic music in North America, returns for its 23rd edition at Quartier de Spectacle. From Tuesday, August 23rd to Sunday, August 28th, vibe to the rhythm of more than 100 local and international artists such as Caterina Barbieri, Cora Novoa, Koreatown Acid, Luke Slater, Max Cooper, and Nicola Cruz. MuTech also has a program dedicated to professionals with its MuTech Forum and Market, which consists of 4 days of exchanges and events centered around digital creation. The complete program and tickets are now available at a preferential rate at montreal.mutech.org. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
MTL versus racism.
Montreal versus racism.
MTL versus racism.
A concert united against racism and discrimination.
Un concert uni contre racisme et la discrimination.
Saturday, the 10th of September, 6 to 10 p.m. in Girouard Park.
Samedi, le 10 septembre, 18h à 22h, à Parc Girouard, Indigé.
Avec des performances de
Jonathan Emile,
Shawit,
Maritza,
Remy Picasso,
Paul Carniello,
DJ Lady Oracle,
Collect de fonds pour Résilience Montréal,
raising money for Resilience Montreal.
Tout le monde et tous les âges sont bienvenus.
Everybody is welcome.
This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Thanks to everyone who donated to CKUT's annual funding drive. Your generosity truly helps keep our engines burning. It's never too late to donate. You can do so by calling 514-907-9424 or going to ckut.ca and hit the green Make a Pledge button at the top. All paid entries will be entered into a grand prize draw. You can pay your pledge and pick up your gift weekdays between 11 to 6 p.m. or by appointments. Call 514-907-9424. Thank you.
The words mental illness, what do you think?
I have friends who don't even know that I suffer from depression.
Why don't they know?
Because I'm scared they'll ostracize me if they know and then they'll abandon me. I don't want to be alone.
You're discriminated against when you have a mental illness. With other illnesses, there's compassion.
It doesn't take much to be diagnosed mentally ill.
Due to an outburst, I was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. And now the doctors say it's something else.
20% of people and counting have had or will have a depression.
People throw different labels around. You're this or you're that.
Everybody psychoanalyzes someone during a conversation.
You have a right to express emotions.
Anger, love, hate, sadness, confusion. It does not mean you're ill.
If you're down and out, seek help. Don't be scared. It can be very intimidating.
There are people listening and willing to help.
We have to innovate.
Get informed. Contact your local CLSC, Sun Youth, and in Quebec, Ford House, or Prevention Suicide.
If your last vaccination against COVID-19 was more than 5 months ago, it's time to get another dose. Boosting your antibodies reduces the risk of getting or transmitting the virus, and booster doses help reduce the number of hospitalizations and deaths related to COVID-19. For better protection against the virus, book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine and follow the recommended vaccination schedule. Vaccination against COVID-19, a good way of extending our protection. A message from the
Good afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.